Real stories, reliable information, the latest technology and news. Welcome to the Plastic Surgery Hub podcast, connecting people with practitioners.
Hey listeners, it's Trish Hammond here again from Transforming Bodies, and today I'm speaking to Dr. Raymond Goh, who's a specialist plastic surgeon based up in Brisbane at Valley Plastic Surgery, at Fortitude Valley, of course. And tonight we're going to actually have a chat about rhinoplasty, revision rhinoplasty, why it's important to get it done right first off, because Dr. Goh is actually doing a lot of revisions at the moment. So we're going to have we want everyone to avoid having to get it done again. Let's have a chat with him. So welcome, Dr. Goh.
Hello, everybody. Thanks, Trish.
Oh, thank you so much for joining us when you could be home with your family having dinner. I'm so sorry to make it so late at night.
No, it's not too bad. We're quite used to it as surgeons.
Yeah, that's so true. That's so true. So tell me, rhinoplasty, I know this is your absolute passion. First of all, what is it about rhinoplasty that makes you love it so much?
I think it's the complexity of it. Every millimeter counts, and there's so much individuality in terms of every patient's nose is slightly different, from the size of the cartilage, the strength of the cartilage, the way the bone's configured to the type of skin that they have, that there is no cookie cutter procedure. It's not like you can just have a particular amount of cc's to put in to get a size. You have to tailor make the procedure and plan for a goal that accommodates the patient's goal and that's possible and realistic. So I think for me, it's a challenging procedure. It's not just trying to get the result good for the first year. It's trying to get a stable, strong, and good looking nose for the rest of their lives. And so for me, my interest in rhinoplasty has developed because of the complexity, the intricacy, and how we're continually trying to improve the outcome for patients.
Mm-hmm. And do you know what I've noticed a lot lately is like there is not that many good rhinoplasty surgeons around Australia. Like, do you know what I mean? It's actually of high demand. I think it's more, I don't know if I'm right or not, but there's more demand than there are good surgeons, because I know a lot of people can do rhinoplasty, but as far as finding a really good rhinoplasty surgeon does a lot of rhinoplasty, it's not easy.
No, and for good reasons. Rhinoplasty is probably the most difficult and complex plastic surgical procedure out there in the world of plastic surgery. Not many people are willing to take it up, and I don't think you should actually do it if you're doing 2-3 a year. If you're doing 3-6 a week, then you will have enough experience to know the different types of noses that are presented to you that the patient aims to achieve. So it's not an easy operation. There are a lot of sort of factors that will determine the final outcome, and patients have to accept that there's always going to be a margin of error, but we do everything we can to try to get it as good as we can. But it's certainly changed a lot in the last 10-15 years, the way we approach rhinoplasty.
Yeah, right. And I guess that's why it's really important that you actually see someone who does a lot of them. Hey, like because exactly like what you said, you don't want to go to someone who just does, you know, a few a year. You want to go to someone who absolutely knows what they are doing.
Absolutely. It's certainly there's a very long and steep learning curve for rhinoplasty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And for most rhinoplasty surgeons, whether we be from ENT backgrounds or when we first finish our training, we haven't done that many rhinoplasties. We know the basic principles behind it, but it certainly takes many years of experience, continual learning, continual analysis of your result to know what works and what doesn't work in which patients to be able to be more confident in what you do in rhinoplasty.
Of course. And I guess because like something like breast surgery or liposuction or, you know, things like that, they're done more often. So, of course, you know, surgeons are doing them all the time. But of course, you know, with rhinoplasty, it can't just be something that, you know, oh, I'm just going to do one here and there because, you know, for the patient to have, well, this is what I'm guessing, but for the patient to have, you know, the best result or the best, you know, the best, you know, way of it succeeding, it needs to really be with someone who is a rhinoplasty specialist. Hey,
I think so. I think you can't just dabble in rhinoplasty. Mm-hmm. And you have to be very focused on it and do a lot of it. And I think it's a continuing process. Even the most experienced rhinoplasty surgeons in the world who have done tens of thousands of rhinoplasty, they are still changing their techniques. They are still analyzing the results and they're still learning. We're always trying our best to improve patient outcome, especially long-term outcome. And a lot of people will say that the nose continues to heal after rhinoplasty, even up to 2 years. So it's important that we have stable, strong results for the long term and not just the short haul.
Yeah. And so do you reckon this could be why you're seeing a lot of revision rhinoplasty? Because I know for a fact from speaking to you before as well, but it is like revision rhinoplasty is the hardest surgery. And I've actually got a friend who's just been going through that now. And it's not easy, hey?
No. You see? Awesome. Loves their work, does not want to revise less than ideal or optimal. Oh, any surgeon who has a passion for their work does not want to revise a less than ideal or optimal result. So that's why we do, especially in rhinoplasty, try to get it as good as we can, as perfect as we can. It will never be perfect. I tell all patients that no nose will be perfect in the long term, but we try to get it as good as we can, better, straighter, and more ideal, because revision rhinoplasty is difficult. There's a lot of scar tissue in there. Things are often distorted. We're not quite sure what the previous surgeons have done. And oftentimes the cartilage that we would use for grafting have already been used or taken from the septum. So we need to take an ear or a rib cartilage to rebuild the nose. And a lot of patients physical as well as emotional trauma. And so to undertake further surgery, that's not going to guarantee a perfect result. That's a lot to take in.
Mm, that's so true. And like with your patients, like is the consult, because I know that a rhinoplasty procedure in general, and it would vary time wise, but they take a lot of hours, don't they? They're not like just a 1 hour surgery. They take forever, don't they?
Yeah. Primary rhinoplasties can be a little bit more predictable, but at the same time, you can only analyze and assess to a certain degree with your physical examination. And sometimes when you go in there, you do have some unexpected findings, such as the shape of the septum, the strength of the cartilage that you have to work with, the shape of the bone. We have average times for primary rhinoplasty. What's a little bit less predictable, because we just don't know sometimes what we're going to come across. And you kind of have to figure things out as you go along. And as you assess what the state of the nose is like, you have to continually change your plan. So they do take a lot longer. And the patients have to be aware that, you know, every millimeter counts in rhinoplasty. And it's not a straightforward procedure. There is a margin of error, and patients have to accept that no nose will be perfect. Every face is asymmetrical, that there will be areas that we can't control, factors that we can't control, such as how the patient heals after an operation. Is there going to be more swelling, more scarring on one side compared to the other? These are the things that we have to look out for during the healing phase. And that's why follow-up is so important as well.
Yeah. And you know, you're absolutely right, because you don't know because it's asymmetrical or symmetrical, whatever. So, yeah, one side could be different to the other, which, of course, is going to change the way you look. So, yeah, patients are going to freak out thinking, oh, my God, it's different. But it could just be the swelling, hey?
Absolutely.
So tell me, I was going to ask you, so with a revision rhinoplasty, like, actually before we talk about that, can you tell us a little bit about, because I know that you know in some rhinoplasties you have to get the rib from another part of the body to actually put it in the nose. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because when I saw that for the first time, I was like, what?
Yeah.
And it's amazing.
Yeah. So The nose is made up of cartilage and bone on the inside, and then you have skin over the outside and skin on the inside. And when someone has already done or had a rhinoplasty, more often than not, their septum, which is a central cartilage structure in the nose, has already been tampered with, whether it's been taken or weakened or used as graft materials. On the nose, which is the best area to get cartilage grafts from, to use to support and structure the nose. So you either get it from the ear, which is cartilage from the ear, or you can get it from the rib. The ear is curved and it's very weak and flimsy. And so oftentimes we'll go to a rib. Now, these days we have the option of either taking the patient's own rib, which is usually a cut on the chest, or we can use an allograft, which is a rib that's been processed from a cadaver. And it's been processed and it's frozen, and we can use that if the patient is not suitable for using their own rib, or if the patient by choice chooses to use a cadaver rib. We need the cartilage from the rib so that we can restructure and rebuild the house. It's like building, to rebuild the nose, it's like building a house. Mm-hmm. You cannot use the rusty corrugated iron and rotten wood to renovate a house. You've got to get new material and strong material to make sure that the nose is rebuilt in a strong way.
Mm, that's so true. And do you find that when you do nose job, because like I had a nose job, you know, about 20, actually I know how long because it's how old my son is, so about 23 years ago. And the doctor said to me at the time, you know, you may choose to come back, you know, within, you know, and if you do come back within a couple of years, you know, we can do a little, you know, tweak here and there if you need it. And of course, I didn't choose to go back. But do you think he said that to me because I, like, in case there was, why would he have said that to me?
I'm not sure, Trish. But when I, with my rhinoplasty patients, I don't plan on a tweak or a revision. I just say to patients, look, we're going to try to get this as close as possible to our goals. And let's hope that we don't need a revision. Mm-hmm. So we have to structure the nose quite strong. And let's just say, give you an example, someone with really thin skin where every irregularity may be visible through the skin over the years, we may put a layer of pasted up or diced up cartilage, maybe mixed in with some fiber and glue over the top of the nose, almost like a red carpet over the top. And this is to mitigate the risk of any irregularities that may show through in the long term. Another example is, for example, the tip can often drop after rhinoplasty if it's not well supported. So these days for most of my rhinoplasty, I will have some kind of tip support graft there to make sure where I put the tip is where it's going to stay for the next 20, 30 years. It may drop a millimeter or two, but it's not going to drop a lot because we've done what we can, as much as we can, to support the nose and stabilize it.
Yes. And, you know, and on that point, it's like if you were to bump it or whatever during what time could you kind of damage it? Like, because I can remember I had a little baby at the time and he bumped his head into my nose and I thought, oh my God, it was just like the most oof pain. But I was worried about something happening to the nose, even though I didn't have anything installed in it, like I didn't have any bone or anything like that, just had it made smaller.
Yeah.
But I was like, oh my God, could that actually mess up the whole thing? Is that possible?
It's possible, but it's uncommon. I think when you've had a rhinoplasty, once the healing phase has been through and your nose is pretty healed and solid, if you're going to break your nose, you're going to break your nose anyway, despite having or not having a rhinoplasty. Certainly the grafts that we put in can break or snap or bend, but it does take a certain amount of force. I have encountered that someone's had a certain smack on their nose. Having said that, that amount of force would have broken the nose anyway. So yeah. I don't really counsel patients to say you need to avoid any sorts of activities. You just live life as you wish. If you're going to break your nose, you're going to break your nose probably anyway.
Mm, that's so true. That's so true. So tell me a little bit about the process for, you know, from start to finish. So if someone either, you know, can't breathe properly, or if they don't like the shape of their nose, or like what would be another reason you might want a nose job?
Yeah.
That's it really.
You've hit the two main reasons why people seek a rhinoplasty or a septorhinoplasty, and that's aesthetic and functional. Functional is just they can't breathe either from one side of the nose or both sides of the nose, and that's either from a deviated septum, mm-hmm. a weak nose that collapses when they breathe in. Aesthetic reasons could be anything, and I usually will spend the first 5 to 10 minutes simply listening to the patient and asking them what bothers you about your nose. Name three top things. Don't name too many, because once you go beyond three, you start to become quite complicated and not quite sure where your aims and goals are. In Australia, you know, the most common presentations are a hump in the bridge and a big and droopy tip. Again, it depends on the demographics. If you live in an area where there's a lot of Asian population, they may come in for an augmentation rhinoplasty where they want a higher bridge and more tip projection. But in general, in Australia, what I tend to see is a dorsal hump and a tip that's a bit bulbous and droopy. And we aim to just give it more balance and a more aesthetic nose. But the reasons that patients come in are both aesthetic and functional. And we usually listen to the patient first to see what concerns them, because it doesn't matter what I think will look like a good nose. It's what the patient wants that matters the most.
Yeah, that's so true. And so if someone does have a nose job, and I know it varies with each different, you know, patient, but what's the kind of expected recovery from it? And is it day surgery or a year overnight?
Most rhinoplasty, I'd say probably 75 to 80% of rhinoplasties can be done as day surgical cases. That is, they go home the same day. Most patients prefer their own bed, their own home to recover in. And there's really no need to stay in hospital for primary cases. Now, it's different when you have a much longer rhinoplasty, such as in revision using a cartilage, and proceed maybe 4, 5, or 6 hours. Then for those cases, I prefer an overnight stay. But there really is no need to stay longer than an overnight. The recovery, by recovery, most patients would mean, when can I go back to work? In general and on average, it's around 2 weeks. Now, some patients, after 1 week, once they've had their external splint and the internal splints and sutures removed, they can go back to work. But some patients with more laborious work or physical type of work may wait 2 weeks before they return to work. I always say to patients to take it easy in the first 6 weeks after rhinoplasty. And that includes exercise, because when you get your heart rate up, your nose will swell up and will take a while for that to come down. So during the healing phase, the initial healing phase, it's important that the patient takes things easy.
Mm-hmm. And do you know, when you, like, say, for example, if you have a facelift, they give you like a headband. Is there any, and actually when I had my nose job, they kind of put this, not a bandage, but like this hard thing around my nose for about a week just to kind of keep it. Still, I guess, is that still the case?
Yeah. So some surgeons will put a actual plaster of Paris cast over the nose. And some surgeons like myself will put a thermoplastic splint, which is a plastic splint that we put in hot water and it molds over the nose. And then we'll often have internal splints. Now, some surgeons will put in packing into the nose. I don't do that. I have a little silicone breathing tube that I put in, and that just splints the septum, because that's usually where we've taken some cartilage out, and I just like to keep them nice and supported and straight. So those internal splints as well as external splints will usually come out and off at 1 week, together with about 4 or 5 stitches just in the bottom central bit of the nose.
And so, you know, you mentioned that like about they might not want to be at work for about 2 weeks, because I did actually go back to work after 1 week myself, because like I just had black eyes. That's all. I just thought like I'd been in a fight or something. Someone said to me, did your husband beat you? I'm like, no, I had a nose job. But 2 weeks, like within that, in that 2 weeks time, like what can they expect to feel like? Do they come back to see you after surgery at all? And if so, like, is it a day after, or what's the process straight after surgery? Yeah.
The process is that they go home on the day of surgery, usually as a primary case. Then my nurses will usually give them a follow-up telephone call the next day to make sure they're doing okay, they don't have any concerns, that their pain's under control, they're taking the medications. Then we'll arrange for their first follow-up appointment, which is usually at 1 week. That's when they have their external splints taken off, their internal splints.
Okay, so you get your splint taken off after 1 week.
Some stitches taken out if that's required. Correct. Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. And then I usually will catch them at around either 2 weeks or 3 weeks. And then I'll see them again at 6 weeks. When the external splint comes off, I'll usually tape the nose. When I tape the nose, I tell the patient it's like a bra for the nose. It helps support the nose and prevents excessive swelling. We don't start sort of massaging the nose until about 4 or 5 weeks. That's when we start to put a bit of pressure on areas that we think are a little bit more swollen, just to control the direction of the healing.
Okay. So, and is there any special, because I'm figuring, because I can't remember mine, it was so long ago, but I would imagine you have to lie straight. You wouldn't want to sleep on your face.
Correct. I tell patients to, it's important to get good sleep for a good healing. Do you encourage them to sleep or rest or lie or sit with the head up a little bit, whether that be on a few pillows or elevate the head of the bed. But if it's uncomfortable, I'd rather them just sleep flat on their back and get a good night's sleep, but definitely not face down.
Yeah, no, exactly. Because you could just bend it or, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Don't want to go through all that and then just kill it with that.
Hmm.
Yeah, awesome. And is there anything that patients shouldn't have leading up to surgery? Like I'm gathering, you know, I know you're kind of disparate, but is there any sort of food or anything that they should stay away from before surgery just to be, you know, like, because you want to be really healthy, of course, before you start surgery, but you want to make sure you're not taking something that you shouldn't be taking as well?
Right. So there's two factors to consider here. Number one is making sure that you don't bleed too much during the procedure. Too much of the operation. And things that you take by your diet, such as, you know, the amount of salt that you take, I prefer patients to cut down on their salt. Cut down any supplements such as garlic, ginger, fish oil, that can cause a little bit more bruising and bleeding. So these are the things that I tell, you know, we have a list of things to try to avoid, such as supplements or blood thinners, excessively salty diet, both before the procedure as well as after the procedure, so you can minimize bruising, minimize swelling, and both of those factors will improve healing and the final result.
Awesome. And when do they get the okay from you that everything's fine, or do they come back every so often? Or
yeah, so I usually see patients week one, week two or three, week six, at 6 months, and at 1 year. And that's usually when I say, if there's any in me, but that 1 year should be fairly stable.
Yep. Awesome. You know, it's really funny. I could talk about noses all day. No, because it's so fascinating that you can actually change the shape of someone's nose. And just before you go, I know there's an open and a closed rhinoplasty. Mm. And with the, like when I, before I had my surgery, I didn't look anything up because I didn't want to know what was happening. Mm. And then I looked up after, I was like, whoa, like I had no idea that, you know, they did, you know, that it was done like it was. But one thing that's amazing, like, is the fact that there's no scar. Like there's a tiny little cut underneath the nose, but the scar just disappears. And I'm like, why is the skin there so different to anywhere else?
Yeah. It's interesting you mentioned that skin in the columella, which is that central bit of your nose, it's where we make the cut. The rest of the cuts are all inside the nose in an open rhinoplasty. In the closed rhinoplasty, the only difference between an open is that 5 millimeter cut in the area that we call the columella, which is the center of between the two nostrils there. That area of skin always heals to become almost invisible. Even in Asian African noses, I've never had a bad or keloid scar. The only time when I've had a bad scar that is in someone who smokes. If you smoke, you're going to get a bad scar anyway.
Yes.
The difference between open and closed, again, it derives from your training as well. You know, in my hands, I mostly do open rhinoplasty because I feel that in my hands, when I can see everything very clearly and have good exposure, that allows me to do things very precisely. In my hands anyway, when I do a closed rhinoplasty, I see less and therefore less confident about the precision of the work. Whereas there are many surgeons around the world who
rhinoplasty. Sorry, the sound went off a bit. What were we saying? There's a few surgeons around the world that what?
Oh, there are a few surgeons that I know of who are very good at closed rhinoplasty because it works well in their hands. So really it depends on what works well in your hands and what you have most experience with.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. So I can remember when I had my nose job. I can't remember what day it was afterwards, but there comes a time when a chunk of blood comes out and you nearly have a heart attack. Is that the same for everyone?
No, it's not. Okay. That chunk of blood is probably a blood clot that was inside the nose, because there will be some bleeding on the inside as well, and that forms a blood clot and be stuck to the internal nasal wall, and one day it just pulls out like a worm.
And so that's fairly normal. Yeah, wish I'd been told about that. I wouldn't have been so anxious if I'd been told about it.
It can be quite uncomfortable when there's a big blood clot in there, and when it comes out, the patient feels like a great relief and they can breathe.
It was such a relief. I was like, oh my God, I feel like I can heal now. Mm. But my recovery was amazing. I never had any problems with my nose job. So I'm like, oh yeah, it's not a big deal. But for some people, it can be a big deal. Hey.
Yes.
Mm. Awesome. Well, I've got to say, have I covered everything? Is there anything else that I haven't asked that you think would be beneficial to know?
I think when patients are preparing to go and see someone for rhinoplasty, there are a few things that I think patients need to know. Number one, do their research.
Yeah.
As we mentioned before, find a surgeon who doesn't just do the occasional rhinoplasty once a month or even once every few months. It's a complex operation. I personally believe it's the most difficult plastic surgical procedure, and it needs a lot of experience and a careful analysis and approach to it. The second thing is that you got to remember that the nose can take 12 to 18 months to fully heal, because it's a small object in the middle of your face that's got very little space for swelling to come through. So sometimes swelling, especially around the tip and the area above and below the tip, can take a good 12 to 18 months to resolve. And patients have to remember that we can do everything perfectly structurally at the time of the operation, but then the patient and follow-up is very important so that we can observe how the patient's healing and guide that healing so that it's heading in the right direction. And patients always have to remember that no nose after rhinoplasty will be perfect. There will be asymmetries as well as imperfections, but overall, the nose will be better. And as long as we can do an excellent job and get an excellent result, although not perfect, then we've reached our goal.
Yep. No, that's so true. And very well said, because it's true. It can never be perfect, because you know it's not perfect to start with usually, right? Anyway, but yeah, at least it can always be better. Yeah, I'm totally happy with mine, and actually I will point something out as well. I know I say this all the time, but I think it's like, and I'm guessing everybody's like this, but you kind of make the nose in proportion to the person's face, don't you? Because like I wanted him to give me a really small nose because I wanted to look like, you know, a little Aussie nose with a little tip at the end that came up and all that. And And my doctor, he goes, no, you're Italian. I can't do that. You look ridiculous. And I was really put out by that. But in hindsight, I have seen where someone has had a nose job and it's too small for their face. So it's really important to get those proportions right. Hey.
Absolutely. The patients can tell us what their wishes are. We can tell them what's possible and what's not. And then we have to come to a compromise somewhere in between a mutually agreed goal. But we know what's like possible that. And what's not.
Yeah, mutually agreed goal rather than this is what I want.
Exactly.
That makes so much sense. I've got to say, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's always so interesting talking to you. And I do love talking about noses. It's I guess because I had one myself. So it's just, you know, I do love talking about noses. So thank you so much for taking the time tonight, Dr. Go.
It's my pleasure, Trish. Sound. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. There's been a few little cutouts of the sound all the way through, but I think that's just the reception on that end. So sorry about that, but
that's all
lovely.
Right.
Thank you.
My pleasure, Trish. All the very best.
Worries. So listeners, if you are looking for an amazing specialist plastic surgeon who does rhinoplasty surgery, definitely check out Dr. Raymond Goh. He's got lots of before and afters on his Instagram. You can go and have a consult and see him and he'll show you a whole bunch more as well. So I can't recommend him highly enough. Thank you so much for joining us tonight, Dr. Goh.
My pleasure, Trish.
Okay, good evening. Bye.
The Plastic Surgery Hub podcast, connecting people with practitioners. For more information, visit plasticsurgeryhub.com.au or email info@plasticsurgeryhub.com.au. The material provided in this podcast is general information and does not constitute medical advice, nor is it a substitute for consultation and advice from your own practitioner. It should not be used to diagnose or treat any medical illness. Any medical or surgical decision should be made in consultation with your own doctor or practitioner and not based on the materials provided in this podcast.